The Guardian.
It is becoming a truth universally acknowledged that any writer in search of a career must at some stage resort to the memoir. This thought came to me when someone at the Hay Festival thrust into my hand a copy of a new book by the potter Edmund Duval. I started reading, and after spending a week utterly and unexpectedly engrossed in it, I just had to make the journey down to his South London studio to find out more.
And so this is my book and pot room. I make pots downstairs, and then finished things come up here.
Although Edmund Duval is best known for his beautiful minimalist ceramics, his latest work is quite different. It's called The Hare with Amber Eyes, and writing it involved reinventing himself as a memoirist and historical sleuth on the trail of the origins of a hidden inheritance left to him by a great uncle. The inheritance was 264 Japanese ornaments called netsuke. And it's rather a sort of Japanese-y space.
It is, actually. It's very Japanese.
It's an unusual form of memoir. He uses the story of these tiny objects to explore the amazing history of his family across the 19th and 20th centuries. It's a very light, bright building with lots of ceramics around the walls. Do you actually keep your collection here, Edmund?
No, the collection is at home, but they're lovely tiny things and they slip into your pocket, so I do actually wander around London on and off with a netsuke in my pocket.
Can you explain to me exactly what a netsuke is?
Yes. It's Japanese. It's very small. It's a carving, either in wood or ivory or bone. And they were used as toggles for a pouch which hangs off your kimono sash. So you have to imagine a very small carving of any number of different plants or animals or people doing odd things, intricately and beautifully and lyrically carved. And you have it hanging there, so you can actually handle it.
How did they come to be in your family's collection?
Well, it's quite a story. I mean, I first found them, saw them, in my great-uncle's collection in Tokyo when I was there studying 30 years ago. And they were a collection that was originally put together in the 1870s in Paris by a great cousin called Charles Effrussi, who was a great aesthete and collector and writer about art, a man of extraordinary taste and extraordinary wealth. And he was a friend of the Impressionists and commissioned them. And
collected He's actually them. In a Renoir picture.
He's in a Renoir picture.
It's a boating party.
The boating party. Mm. So he moved in these extraordinary circles, and there was this sort of passion for Japanese objects and Japanese paintings as well and prints and lacquer.
So this was just after the opening up of Japan?
Just after the opening up. And so they're part of that very specific moment. And so he's one of the sort of pioneer collectors.
The thing that really struck me about this book that seemed really unusual is the way you've constructed memoir through objects. So instead of taking a psychological approach, the psychology comes out of what you observe.
One of the extraordinary things about this sort of quest was to find out where they'd been and what they meant to all the people who've handled them over the last 150 years, which is a stupid thing to try and work out. I mean, why would you try and write a history of objects in that way? Really a history of touch, trying to find out what objects mean to people. The thread of how they lived with objects seemed to me a very real one. I mean, that's what I do for my living. I'm a potter. I care about objects. And I'd inherited this collection, which is about all about picking things up. Mm. And so I felt that that was a real way of connecting these people across the generation.
And then he gets bored of it.
He gets bored.
He's a man of fashion. He has to move.
He's absolutely a man of fashion. Things moved on. And he grew even grander. He moved to a wonderful, huge new house with his brother, who he lived with. And they didn't fit. And so when my great-grandfather, Victor, was getting married in 1899... his first cousin, his favourite first cousin, he sent us a wedding present, this huge vitrine, with these netsuke. So they arrive in this new place, the second resting place for this collection, just at the turn of the century, in this vast palace on the Ringstrasse, this Palais Effrussi it was called.
So how did the netsuke fit in there? Because they're quite little things, aren't they? They're not grand.
They're not grand at all. When this great wedding present arrives, My great-grandmother and great-grandfather didn't know what to do with it. It didn't fit in with this great grand house they'd inherited. And so it ends up in my great-grandmother Emmy's dressing room. And she was a great beauty and lived for...
Her lovers?
Her lovers, actually. Yes, she lived for her lovers. She lived for this extraordinary series of people in her life, including my great-grandfather.
For whom she had to change three or four times a day. So she spent a lot of time with the Nets cake.
Absolutely. So this is the room, which is actually really the kind of, the living heart of the house.
And because they were rich and very cultured, they left a lot of written record of themselves and their possessions, didn't they? And then, of course, bringing us to the saddest part of the story.
The great moment of crisis, the moment when the fault line on which they are living finally cracks open, of course, is in 1938 at the Anschluss, when Austria is taken over, welcomes the Nazis in. Their house is broken into and there are thugs and things are stolen, and a great famous desk is heaved over into the courtyard, three stories below.
And everything gets lost.
Everything gets lost. They flee. My great-grandmother commits suicide in our house in Czechoslovakia, and my great-grandfather gets to England in 1939, just before the war.
But the Netske find their way back.
And it's an extraordinary story, which is that at the moment of the Anschluss, when the house is being taken apart, ripped apart, Anna, who's Gentile, my great-grandmother's maid, she takes the Netske one by one and she hides them, and she hides them in her mattress. After the war, my grandmother goes back in 1945, and Vienna's in ruins, opens the door, and she goes in. There's a nice American there who says, "Well, I'm afraid you can see there's nothing really here," and there isn't. And there's Anna. Anna's in the house, and Anna says, "I've got something to give back to you."
Tell us a bit about the process of writing this. I mean, you've obviously got absolutely obsessed with scurrying around looking for bits of paper in archives all over Europe, really.
I look back with such naivety. I began, and I thought, well, I know the story pretty much, and I know where some of the records are, that's fine. I'll do a bit of reading about Belle Epoque Paris, and I'll go and walk around Vienna a little bit, and that's it, sorted. And of course what happens is you're in the library and one thing leads to another, and then you're in an archive and the questions unravel and unravel and unravel, and you find yourself spending a week looking at bank records, or you start looking at the fashion for fur tippets in the 1890s or something, and you think, well, I'm lost. There is this compulsion to keep on going, which is very scary, actually, because you think, I'm never going to write this book. For me, part of the book is it's the journey of trying to find a way of finishing.
In a way, the Netske save the story, don't they, as well? They save you.
Yes. I've actually got some Netske here, so if you want to come upstairs.
Oh, absolutely. Let's go upstairs. Rather steep stairs going up.
Yeah, these are absolutely lethal, so take care. Here are some Netske.
The Netske, look at them. Am I allowed to touch them?
Of course you are. That's kind of the point.
But they look so... There's a little woman in a bar.
You've got animals, you've got rats, you've got... Here's a whole tumble of tortoises.
They're about an inch by an inch, and some of them are made of ivory, is it?
Yes.
And then some of them are made of wood.
Yes, all different kinds of wood.
And they're very cuddly, almost. And you have a sense of all the little hands that must have held at them over the years as well, don't you? Tell us about now and the future. You have children. Do they play with these?
Yes, they do.
And what will happen to them in the future?
I guess my kids will have them. If my kids have them, that's six generations, which is pretty good.
And you'd keep them as one collection, would you? Do you think it's important that they're all together?
Do you know what? I that's not my problem.
That's your children's problem to sort out.
It so is.
Edmund Duval. The Hair with Amber Eyes is published by Chatto & Windus. I have to say, the Netske were absolutely fantastic. In fact, Lisa, the editor of Guardian Review, was so inspired by the book that she bought two Netscape off eBay. I took them along to show Edmund. He was very tactful and rather liked the little brown owl, but he suspected the other rather grander one was actually a modern chess piece, which was rather disappointing. Well, with me to discuss the art of the memoir here in the studio, Richard Lee, a writer and editor on the Guardian Books website.
Hello.
And the novelist Maggie G, whose most recent book, My Animal Life, is a memoir. It's an account of her own progress on this planet.
Hello.
Is that a correct representation, Maggie?
Yes, I think so. I think I was trying to understand what happens to me in this very brief illuminated period between two silences, two dark bits.
We'll come back to that a little bit later. Now, Edmund's odyssey to research his memoir took him on this massive adventure into his family's history. Did you find that writing your memoir took you to places you hadn't expected to go?
By the end of it, I think I understood a lot more. But for me, I think the big thing was that as a novelist, in a sense, the novelist is always hiding. That, I mean, maybe the characters are aspects of oneself and aspects of people you know, but you're never there. And indeed, the characters who are most like you are often the ones you laugh at, you ironise, because there's nothing more boring than a character who shares your opinions and is the hero. So there's a sense in which everything is hidden. And I think I thought, now it's time to try and understand my own life and to give a kind of framework into which the novels fit. Mm. My last two novels had really been, there's a character like me who is, she's very much seen from the outside as a comic character. And I think when you've done two books where someone like you is a comic character, you quite want to say, I'm not just a comic character, I'm real.
Mm. That was My Cleaner and My Driver, your two yes. most recent novels. Just going back to the materiality of your memoir, obviously you do a lot of evoking of what your family, the G's and the Churches, looked like. I mean, in, you know, they're this sort of period feel to what their physicality. Some of them were small, some of them were big.
Yes, and I think it's very important, your grandparents' houses, what you remember of that. You do indeed have to talk about objects, as I think what you're saying about the Netsuke. I mean, yes, I did have to remember their few books. I had to remember what they ate, what the kitchen was like, what the outside loo was like. Those things are very important and they trigger memory.
We are living through a huge boom in this genre, aren't we, Richard?
Yes, the modern memoir boom starts in the late 90s with the invention of the misery memoir by Dave Peltzer and Frank McCourt, both of whom went on to sell millions of copies. Dave Peltzer sold 4 million copies of his first three books in the UK alone, whereas Frank McCourt, who Angela's Ashes, sold 10 million copies in the US. These terrible stories of children being abused, beaten, neglected by their parents, but in some way triumphing over it, that reached out to readers who, as publishers said, didn't usually read books. Mm. And off the back of that, following this massive success, there's been a willingness, I think, for publishers to put out books by, as it were, proper writers or writers who are writing other things already.
Such as Lorna Sage's Bad Blood, which actually came to mind when I was reading My Animal Life quite a bit, because you have this narrative of empowerment by a grammar school education.
Yeah, I think that's true. Certainly one of the central themes in My Animal Life is how you become a writer, how you can become a writer when you don't come from that sort of background at all. But I'm a little bit wary about the idea that memoirs are very, very successful at the moment, because I think if you talk to agents and publishers, they will tell you that it rather peaked in terms of literary memoir 2 or 3 years ago, and that in fact there was then a vast inflation of the misery memoir and celebrity memoir in particularly, which has kind of driven the other stuff off the bookshelves.
Richard, is that your impression?
I think there have been sales figures from 2008 or so which have shown a decline. Mm. But there's still a tide of the books coming through, as you
Any
say.
Any good ones?
Well, just earlier this year, there's Bobby Baker's diary drawings, a kind of drawing diary of her struggles with mental illness. And this month there's Patricia Morris-Rowe's Wide Awake, which is an account of her troubles with insomnia. And then next month there's Candia McWilliam, and then Alistair Gray, A Life in Pictures, due in October. So I think there's any sign of a let-up in this.
What made you want to write a memoir, Maggie? You're a novelist. I mean, at the beginning I described you as a novelist. Do you think of yourself as a novelist who has happened to write a memoir, or are you a writer who mostly writes novels?
Well, I'm a writer. Fiction is my profession. I see it as something about being human. I want to understand my life and I want to offer that to other people. And I think we all ask some of the same questions, which are things like, how can you be happy? How can you forgive your parents? How can you forgive yourself? Questions like that. And in a curious way, I found that in a memoir, I think perhaps because you earn it by talking about the hard times honestly, and I believe in being honest about things going wrong and failure, I think then that means you can write about love and happiness. And there's a truth, I think, to the idea that in fiction, happiness sometimes writes white, i.e. it's impossible to do it. But somehow in a memoir, I felt I could say something about how to be happy.
But what makes you think that people will want to read it?
Because I think everybody asks at my age, you know, when you've been alive for quite a few decades, you do start trying to forgive yourself and trying to understand why you did things, why certain relationships didn't work, why some did work.
Mm. But you think that writing about that in the mode of memoir, where truth is at stake, that gives you opportunities that you wouldn't have in making up a story?
I really do. And to me, it's very important that I tried to write the truth for me in my memoir. Now, I know that there's a whole debate about how much memoirs are true, but for me, I really wanted there not to be a sentence in there that wasn't true.
Richard, this ties in quite interestingly with David Shield's book, Reality Hunger, which came out earlier this year, which challenged the idea that fiction was actually what people wanted anymore, and was saying actually what we want is the real, the hard.
Yes, I think he's arguing for a very much more kind of mongrel form than the memoirs that we've been discussing, in that his prescription for fiction is a kind of cut-up montage where readers aren't sure whether something is true or made up or comes from somewhere else. But I think that he's suggesting that this is what people want because of a kind of general wish for slightly more reality in our lives. 24-hour television, Facebook, all of these general openness to giving and sharing, which I think wasn't there 10 years ago, is the same thing that's driving the problems that he has with fiction, and is perhaps something that's provoked readers to want to read more memoir rather than made-up stories. Mm.
You see, this is what bothers me about mongrel forms, as you call them. When people don't tell the truth, they don't quite tell the truth. They don't usually do it to disadvantage themselves. They usually do it to improve the truth a bit. And we all do that in real life. But in books, I rather feel we should really try.
You think it's an easy way
out? To be honest, I think it's a bit of an easy way out. The ones that say, this is my life. And then a few months later, they have to say, when the brother pops up and say, no, our father wasn't an alcoholic. They have to say, well, yeah, but it's a good book. I don't like that.
Well, thank you very much, Richard and Maggie, for coming in. My Animal Life is published by Telegram Books. Now, the closest cousin of memoir is, of course, biography, which can also be used to tell stories beyond a single life. One such is Adina Hoffman's My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness, A Poet's Life in the Palestinian Century, which has just won the Wingate Prize awarded by the Jewish Quarterly for books which stimulate an interest in Jewish concerns. It's been described as one of the 5 must-read books on the Israel-Palestine tragedy, and not only the biography of a remarkable man, but an act of reclamation against the erosions of memory. Among its many admirers is The Guardian's Middle East editor, Ian Black, who met Adina on a rare visit to London to pick up her prize and asked her how the book came about.
The book is, for lack of a better term, a life and times of this wonderful poet and person named Taha Muhammad Ali. Taha Muhammad Ali is probably not a household name in Britain or in the Middle East, for that matter, but he is an exceptional figure and someone who I came to know through my husband, Peter Cole, who's a poet and a translator, and became Taha's English translator, his primary English translator. And the two of them were invited to read at various places in the States and in Europe. And I would sort of tag along on these trips. And I was really there at first just as a kind of observer and baggage carrier and whatnot. But the more time I spent with Taha, the more I came to see that his story and his life, in a way, were, I found myself really just fascinated by them. And I decided at a certain point I did set out to write about Taha. It began with Taha, I should say. It kind of expanded from there into really the story of something much larger. I mean, it's a microcosmic view of the Palestinian century.
Many people have pointed out that you chose a subject remarkable in a sense, not because he wasn't interesting and worthy and highly articulate, but who was really very little known.
Right.
The same thing occurred to me. Why not choose Mahmoud Darwish or Sami Al-Qasim, one of the far better known Palestinian writers, poets, who in their own work and lives would much more have embodied the issues at the heart of the conflict. I know you said you didn't want your choice to be representational, right. I think you said. But nevertheless,
it ends up being. He becomes a representative, of course. Yeah. I think in a way, I started out not planning to have a representative. I started out interested in this one man and thinking that I would just write his life. And as I entered into that life, it became clear to me that this larger story was the one that I wanted to tell. I would actually disagree, though, in terms of who is and who isn't representative, because I think in many ways, Taha Muhammad Ali actually is deeply representative of that Palestinian story. Taha is someone who comes from a village where most of the people were farmers. Many of them were illiterate. It was a very rich village culturally and agriculturally. It was completely destroyed in 1948. And Taha himself then basically lived with his family in Lebanon for about a year and then came back to Israel. They had to sneak in. They had basically become sort of illegal aliens in Israel, what had been Palestine and was now Israel. And he set out to set up a new life for himself and his family there by doing what he'd always done. He'd been working from a very young age because his father had polio and he had to support them. So that he started a little shop and that grew. And he runs the largest and most successful souvenir shop in Nazareth. He had to teach himself really from the ground up the classical Arabic tradition and immerse himself in modern Arabic letters. He taught himself English. And in all of these ways, I think Taha's life does embody something quintessentially Palestinian. He's had that sort of deep peasant experience. And so for me, there is a way in which Taha is completely exceptional, I think. But at the same time, there's something very ordinary about Taha. And it was that sort of intersection of those two different extraordinary and ordinary things that made him, for me, ultimately absolutely representative.
Were you making a conscious attempt to try to reconcile narratives? Everybody who's interested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict knows that you can find accounts of the same event which describe it in completely different ways. I was really struck forcefully by the document that you found in the archives proving beyond doubt that the Safaria, the village, was actually bombed. And the document, I think, was marked destroy after reading. Were you trying to provide an overall objective view of something that in microcosm could represent the whole of this conflict?
Yeah, well, first of all, I shy away from terms like objective because I'm not sure that anyone in this case is particularly objective, including myself. I think I actually started with a slightly more modest goal, which was really to try to reconcile things for myself. And in that particular instance, I needed to make sense of the story of that particular night. I was faced with really contradictory versions of what had gone on. The people from Taha's village told me to a one that planes had come and dropped bombs on the village. And then when I interviewed this man, this commander of the battalion, he was adamant about the fact that there had been no bombs and no planes. And he's someone who's quite an honest person, and so I had reason to believe him as well. So that what I was faced with was somebody was not telling the truth. For that reason, I set out and went to the archives, and I did find, I think, proof that, in fact, bombs were dropped on the village, or somebody dropped bombs, if we want to make it active. So that what set out as a kind of maybe simple narrative task did expand, I think, into something larger.
You write in the prelude to your book, the idea of a Jew like me writing about and expressing a tacit identification with an Arab like Taha may provoke suspicion in some readers. I wondered if you could just ponder that very interesting point for a minute. Perhaps from both sides, I imagine you must have had at very least raised eyebrows about the subject that you chose to spend several years of very hard work on.
No, I've had raised eyebrows in all sorts of directions. And I mean, this is the reason why I was reluctant at first to set out and write this book at all, because I knew that I was going to get flack, because how can you not? Basically, as a Jew who opens up her mouth and says anything that is not in some ways completely supportive of every policy of the state of Israel is liable to get into a certain kind of trouble. But again, for me, the emphasis has been on a kind of humanity, and that can sound a little bit sort of touchy-feely, but I don't mean it in that way. I mean in the most serious human way. And for the most part, people have been very welcoming of that.
Isn't one of the most striking things about life in Israel today, striking and depressing, as to how little human contact there is between, certainly between Israelis and Palestinians who live in the occupied territories in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but even really between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. There was a line that struck me when I read your book. You write, for better or for worse, there are others in this picture, and I am one of them. I wondered how that relates to this question of Arabs and Jews in Israel, a country which, you know, as we all know, is never out of the news, and it's mostly mostly pretty bad.
Absolutely. I was always struck as I was working on this book by I spent a lot of time in Nazareth, which is the largest Arab city in Israel. And it was like going to another world from the world that I live in. It's another world. It was a very welcoming world to me, but it's a world that many Israeli Jews find incredibly threatening. And I guess the line that you quoted, I mean, for me, part of the challenge of writing this book was not in attempting to write that sort of objective history of the conflict, which is so often what one gets. I really felt that in order to enter deeply into this history in the way that would be meaningful to me, but also I hope to other readers, I had to put myself in this picture, in this frame, and in a sense lead the reader into this other world. So that's at some level what I was attempting to do there.
You've looked at some of the most difficult and painful and to some irreconcilable issues at the heart of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Do you think it will be possible in the future for there to be some kind of reconciliation based on a sort of mutual recognition of the suffering of the other, to understand more than many seem to do about the circumstances in which the State of Israel came into being, despite the terrible effect it had on them?
It's possible. I guess several things come to mind, one of which is that I don't honestly know that we're very near any sort of reconciliation right now. I have to say that living in Jerusalem and looking out my window, I think things haven't looked so bleak for quite a long time. On the other hand, you know, there is a kind of, I write in the book about Emil Habibi and his pessimist, who is the ultimate sort of figure of, I aspire to be a pessimist, who knows what will be. Some recognition of the other's suffering has to take place, but I don't know that that in itself can be the foundation of anything lasting or real.
Ian Black with Adina Hoffman. My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness is published by Yale. And that's it from us today on the Books Podcast. We'll be back next week with news of the fortunes of independent publishers. And don't forget to check out The Guardian Review, in which Posy Simmons and Simon Armitage go to Glastonbury. That's on Saturday, while on Sunday, Rachel Cook in The Observer Review sets off in search of the real Philip Larkin. If you have any views on memoirs as a genre, or indeed you have any you're burning to recommend, please do email us at guardian.co.uk/books. Until next week, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.